Okay. September 21. 1505, who cares? Close enough. Call to order. Taz and Monique are sick. Jim is on the phone, or?
And Paul.
And Paul.
Hello there.
Welcome, gentlemen. Appreciate it, as always.
Thank you. Happy to help.
Yeah, we're muddling our way through it. We're making progress. So, item two, issues to address, draft number four. I'm assuming you guys got a current copy.
Yes, sir.
That's the 817 draft.
Or is it today's draft?
Right now, we're focused on the co-location language, which James had done in a separate document. You saw it at the last meeting, and it's the date on it is
810.
It's a section draft, Wireless Communications Ordinance Article 99, and he did not have a section number on that because we didn't know what section we were going to put it in. I have since put that into the September 14th draft. It's just been handed out to you and emailed to you, Jim and Paul. And so that language is now just been folded into the draft ordinance. What number is it?
Where is it? Where does it show up?
It is under. Oh, your phone's okay.
That's the thing while you're here.
How about that?
It is on page 4. Under application requirements and permit review.
Oh, so that's the first section flushed out.
That's a great spot for it.
Okay.
I like it.
And all of what James gave you last time is put in there. Couldn't make any changes to it.
No.
So if there are any comments on co-location standards, we can kind of get through that and put that portion to bed.
It's here. Oh, it's just not titled the same thing.
Look at B, co-location permit requirements on page 4.
So that's what that is.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like. Now,
James said this is a separate document. I just got and pasted it. And then your comments, William CSC comments, are highlighted, the note in yellow, and in blue below that, two comments you had on this. Now, there's been a little renumbering because it's renumbered now to make it part of the ordinance. So your reference to A applications and A7, I think, is a little different, but we can figure that out.
Okay, so I can. I didn't bring everything. So you handed the. Oh, here it is. We discussed this. I have a big check through it. So it sounds like I was happy before.
So let me get this right. Are we talking about what's in blue right now?
On page 4 of the draft.
Okay, 4.
Under 99050.
Yes.
B. Co-location permit requirement.
Okay.
And Steve was not at the last meeting, so this is probably the first time you've seen this.
So I missed one, I guess. I wasn't sure how
many.
Okay.
I think this is the one that you missed where we last discussed it.
I sort of did.
So, James, if you want to, can you do a brief recap on what that says?
Okay.
I'll be back.
Essentially, this is the same language that was in the first original draft. I didn't want to recreate the wheel on this, so I just pulled out what the previous director had written up as a co-location criteria. I pulled it out and dropped it into this format here. Original site plan. You know, I'm not seeing anything that really jumped out at me. I thought this committee had reviewed it originally when the previous director was here.
Mm-hmm.
I thought everyone was satisfied with the language in it. I don't really have anything to point out.
Me too. I'm almost done. I'm sorry, catch up.
Okay, well, I've made it all the way to B, performance standards, so that's a separate issue.
Yes.
So at this point, then, I would have to ask on 3, it says, a signed statement from the property owner and service provider acknowledging liability for removal. I guess the and, it seems to me, how do you have both, you know, liable? Maybe the wording down below that I don't fully understand supports that, perhaps? If no agreement exists, require a new performance agreement to achieve adequate security, security based on the fact someone's going to take it out. How do you hold two people mutually responsible for something that, you know, I don't know, what if the first person doesn't, the second has to? I mean, is that what that means, and? It seems awkward to me.
We're looking at
page 5, 3A.
Yeah. Three, top sentence, property owner and the service provider acknowledging liability for removal of the facility and support structure.
Should we change that to an or?
And, or.
So my question is, how do you hold, you know, both responsible for one thing?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to what degree? Ultimate? I mean, what, if the service provider doesn't take it out, then the landowner is ultimately responsible? It would be first be the responsible of the service provider, so not the landowner. So, and just seems like something I don't understand how to work with.
Well, the same provision of the landowner would require a tower to come off his property if it was no longer being used and it wasn't being paid to the lease, right?
Sure. Okay. Sure.
For a co-location, are you going to require a landowner to say, got to come to me to put up another antenna on a tower I'm already renting to him or leasing to him?
How's that?
I understand that. Well, if you're the service provider and you have the tower,
well, let me take that word service provider out. The colo, it's that ambiguous. So if you own it, if a company A owns the tower,
okay.
Well, let's just say it's colo and company B's on there too.
Okay.
What are the scenarios? Company A could quit paying.
Well, no, that have nothing to do with it.
Well, then it would be required to go. I mean, who would be required to go? I don't really understand. Is this required for the lookout? So if A quits paying, he owns it, and B's a colo. I mean, the landowner's obligated to take it out, even though there's a, you know, it gets messy. I don't know. It just seems a little rough. I mean, I'm just looking at the scenarios, and I don't see how this
fits. What was your intent there, guys?
How would you word that?
Well, I don't know.
I'm kind of reaching back to the previous director, because that's where this language came from. So that I cut and pasted it right from his old review.
Micro stuff?
Yeah.
In this case, what's the definition of service provider? If there's three on there, they're all providing service.
Yeah. I believe that...
Whenever you get a permit, you're making the statement. So
it would, so there could be multiple service providers.
Sure.
So now if the landowner, any or all of the service providers, but the one who owns it may have bailed. It's messy. I don't mean to complicate things. I usually don't have much of this kind of crap to throw at you, but it stuck out like a sore thumb to me.
Yeah.
By the whole pea ant brain.
That's why you're here.
The only reason that a facility would be removed is if everyone on it walked away from it.
So basically it's up to the service provider to work amongst themselves. If the owner wishes to split, an additional service provider, company B, may choose just buy the assets. That's kind of up to them. If no, if they can either reach an agreement or they can all bail. If it bails, the original owner of it should be required to take it out. And then what? If he doesn't, then it's up to the landowner to get stuck with it? Or the seems fair?
Well, the landowner would get stuck with it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So be it.
That's basically how it works.
Yeah.
I know. For I like to use another example I can think of on billboards. And other kinds of signs, you know, very similar thing.
Okay.
Oftentimes there'll be a moratorium on signs over a particular size.
Okay, certainly.
And they'll pass new sign ordinance, and then if any sign exists, it can exist for up to 10 years. And at that point, either the owner of the sign or the property owner ultimately has to take it down.
So I guess then, owner beware. There should be wording in the contract between the owner of the tower, who's going to permit it there, get a permit to put it there, and the land owner, that they have their own terms, you know, $5 a month, whatever it's going to be, that when it's done, you got to take it down, not me, the landowner. So that's their terminology.
Paul and Jim, how do those contracts usually look? Does it have a clause in them that between the property owner and the service provider, what happens if the tower is no longer in use?
Paul, you want to field that one? I don't deal with it. It's usually the lease agreement. I don't deal with leases so much, but I know enough to to answer this question.
But it would be, could be, should be.
Yeah,
so.
Usually the lease will have some language in there saying that upon abandonment of the our facility, for example, if it's no longer needed, then the tower owner will remove the
certainly.
Remove the tower and bring it back okay. to, you know.
So certainly back to
the conditions.
So back to the landowner.
That is exactly right. Paul was more of the permitting land use specialist. I deal with the leases every day, and that's what our leases say. If we terminate our agreement with the landowner, we're obligated to remove our facilities and return the premises to the landowner and the premises or in the condition we found it originally. Reasonable wear and tear, that's our standard language.
Okay, so
yes, we would be obligated to take it. And if we fail to do that, they would bill us. They have the right to do it themselves and remove it, but we always remove ourselves.
Gotcha. Okay, so then paragraph A, is the and in that wording sufficient to support what we now do just learned and understand? You guys need to help me on that, everybody.
I see your point how it gets a little bit messy because you make two parties responsible for one thing. What other counties have done is they just say provide a statement or a portion of the lease which says that the tower will be removed. Not all leases do include that language. I think most of them do. So if the lease doesn't contain that language, then they need to provide some sort of statement saying that
okay.
it will be removed. And I think that this language here addresses that. The one thing I do have noticed in this language here, talking, you know, this is for co-locating on an existing tower, and it talks about removal, acknowledging liability for removal of the facility, which I assume is the co-located equipment, and support structure. And if I'm a co-locator, if I'm Company A co-located on Company B's tower, so I don't own the tower, I can't make a statement saying I can remove the tower because we don't own the tower, we're just co-locating on the tower. So that's kind of it's one thing I noticed in here.
Okay.
So
you can't be responsible for removal of the tower when you don't own the tower. There could be other co-locators up on the tower, like you guys said.
Well,
they're all gone. The tower should probably.
I think we take it out of the co-location section entirely. The more I read it, the more I think it's inappropriate to have it there. And frankly, if we are going to keep it there, I'd want to talk to our own legal staff about that because requiring a statement from somebody acknowledging their liability with the responsibility on them that may be beyond what we can actually require.
Require what you can require. Yeah,
because it's a private contractual agreement, that may be where we leave it.
Most removal language is for the tower, not so much for COLA.
Right, and I'm thinking, of, you know, we've identified what the issue is. I just think it's in the wrong spot. And so if that goes under the siting standards for a new tower.
There you go.
Dan,
yeah.
I like your idea, but it was Jim or Paul. I treat you as one and the same. The voice on the phone. Then I would prefer to see reference to the tower and just a show us in a lease agreement where somebody's got the responsibility for taking it down.
Right.
Like a lease agreement, the excerpt, you know, portion of the lease agreement or some other sort of documents.
Okay, so let's strike three from the...
Strike it from the co-location portion and take the concept and move it to towers.
And then I have some things
to follow. Finish.
So and that would be our just new application. Is that generally what the area is?
I'm not concerned about this.
What's that?
That would be our new applications. That's what you were saying. That would generally be relocated. Is that the correct title? Yeah. New applications. I'll make my notes at least accurate as we go along. Keep my brain screwed on straight.
Might start now.
Well, I've had a vacation. I'm coming back more primed. I've seen a lot of world, which gives me a different opinion as well, to be shared. So
I have some comments on a different section.
Before we leave co-location.
Oh, no, it's on that section. I just mean a different section of co-location.
Okay. We had two comments from you here. Are you coming up with something else?
I'm willing to forget to not worry about those. I think we actually discussed it last time. I'm fine. And we figured out that it was covered in other areas, and I'm fine to just let those go.
Okay.
Those being?
The yellow and the gray.
Oh, okay. Keep me caught up here, guys.
Yeah. So it's a different area of this that I'd like to address.
Okay, so we're doing that now. Okay, so I need to read this.
No, we're getting rid of the yellow and the gray. Because
okay.
I think we discussed it, but we pretty discussed this last time.
So your question?
So my comment, if you look also in your packet, you have CAC suggested as 817 draft. And if you go to 99.0, right on the first page, number 4, 99.050, we have some about the pre-application. Everything else we're totally happy with, all looks good. But the pre-application, we want more. So here is written what we suggested. One is just adding a period, which I think is probably okay. And this gets us back, you know, to, because what this talks about is a graphic representation of the search ring. And my whole argument that search rings are, there are criteria embedded in a search ring. And the criteria embedded in the search ring, one, I've been getting more and more educated about, which is that the search ring is going to look different depending on what megahertz equipment you're using. And I'm getting educated that there's more limitation than I thought on what megahertz a company can use.
Which is what I was trying to tell you all along.
Yeah. I still think it's somewhat relevant, but more than that, the information that feeds into a search ring is what is considered coverage. You know, again, are we talking about 70%? Are we talking about 90%? And that would give you a different search ring.
Well, certainly.
So in terms to avoid that, or to, you know, this is number 4 that we're proposing.
We can't avoid it.
Yeah, but we can elucidate what we're basing it on.
You mean picking a number, 70, 80, 90?
Or showing this is the search ring if we're going for 70, this is the search ring if we're going for 90.
Well, 90 sounds good to me.
Why would we do that?
Doesn't necessarily sound good to me.
I knew that.
Why would we do that pre-op? Why would we do that at pre-op?
You would do that in application, not pre-op.
I am not committed to doing it at pre-op.
This is kind of the concept you want to throw in, and whether that happens at the application itself or pre-op is...
Right. It's only in, it came out at pre-op just because of the languaging. They'll submit a graphic representation of the search ring, but just that is not really meaningful, because then any criteria that they want to, that's the applicant wants to use.
I would be comfortable with I like the terminology, current coverage map of the service area of concern. That point number one that you have under A, using that instead of graphic representation of the search ring. I think that
gives two different things.
A better picture.
It's two different things. One is, the first one is, it informs the gap in service. It's something that's leading to, look, we really have a gap in service. This is our current coverage.
Okay.
The search ring is about where do we need to put the antennas to fill that gap of
correct.
Service.
Correct. That would
be
great.
That's why one is there and two is there.
Yeah, the only thing I have a problem with two is using each megahertz available, because they may have something available, but it might not be in this market.
Well,
they're only going to use one.
Yeah.
I'll clarify that.
Available per existing network infrastructure, meaning if AT&T comes into the area and they have a 19 megahertz system in this entire licensed area, MSAs, RSAs, they're not going to put in a 700 megahertz system. It may not even be available. It may not be licensed to them. In some areas, they may have nationwide licenses for both. There comes the problem. If they're using a given network here, then they should be allowed to continue with that megahertz equipment to fulfill that contiguous network requirement. Contiguous not meaning geographically, meaning electronically, how this system functions, how it handshakes. It's the same. For instance, if you own a fleet of vehicles, because you're a big company, and you've got all Jeep Cherokees, and someone wants to show you a Chevy Love truck, it just isn't going to work for you. That's my analogy. So they should be allowed to continue to use the network, the frequency megahertz range, which they are currently using in this licensed area, this existing geographical network.
So help me understand,
okay.
And maybe that's true. I'm just doing one of Why? Because phones pick up all the... Why? Because phones, the phones these days will work on...
Well, here,
they're made to adapt. And
well, here, and here is why. Mm-hmm. Because very precise, concise contouring, they call it, designing of the system, power levels, antenna types, antenna locations, and antenna orientations go out to provide a range of service areas. It's a contour, it curves it like a puzzle piece. They have to design these things very precisely such that handoffs occur so that you can roam from one to the other seamlessly. And all that overhead support for engineering network, the switch handoff has to be consistent. It has to conform to a sense of consistency. It can't just be, oh, we'll use these megahertz here and these here. Because all those, so many parameters change, it wouldn't work right. Even though the phone could say, oh, I see ID code so-and-so as AT&T, I'm going to switch to 700. But all the contours go to hell. It's like a turn of punch bowl.
Yeah, this is Paul. I have to agree with that. Unfortunately, it's not that simple. You can have one wireless company that has, let's say, they have licenses to operate on, say, three different frequencies, 850, 1900, and the 700 gigahertz frequency range. And each of those frequencies provides services for different sorts of technologies. One is,
that as well.
The other one is for data, and another one could be for other services.
Good point. I omitted that. Yes.
If you're going to install a wireless facility, you can't really pick and choose. The network has to be uniform across. I mean, phones can pick up multiple frequencies, but each of those frequencies is for a different sort of service, whether it's for phone or for voice or for data or for other features. And so you can't have just one cell tower, let's say, have voice on 850 megahertz on cell tower A, and on cell tower B right next door where it needs to hand off, move that frequency, voice frequency, from 850 to say 1900. It screws up the whole system. It has to be uniform across the network. So you can't just pick which frequency works best for you for voice. And when companies put it, if they have license for all those frequencies, they're going to want to deploy it, and they're putting in a new cell site, co-located or whatever, they're going to want to put in antennas which can accommodate each of their services for phone data and that sort of stuff. So they're going to be using all of their frequency, all the license frequency that they have available to them to provide all these services. They can't just pick which frequency they want to use at this cell tower and go with it. They're going to, if they have a license for multiple frequencies, they're going to use those frequencies at the site, at the proposed site. So,
So then there's a question. So then they have to pick the, because if, let's see, what's my question? So then they have to pick the site that's going to work for the most challenged megahertz, which would be, let's say, 1900, carries the least far and goes into buildings the least. So they have to choose a site that works for 1900, if that's one of the frequencies they're using, even though a different site might work fine for the 700 and the 850. Is that what you're saying?
That seems to make sense. I'm not an RF engineer, so I don't know that level of detail, but it stands to reason that the search string would then be kind of a composite of all of their frequency, all those frequencies and their coverage.
Well, it's not really a composite, because it's not really a composite, it's a different frequency.
We record these meetings. And when you get two of you having a conversation in the background, Toronto's talking to these guys on the phone.
We're trying to clarify a question.
That gets muddled. Paul, I'm sorry, whoever was speaking last.
Yeah, I can't remember. I think Siobhan had asked the question.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's necessarily composite but it's not as simple as just picking one of these frequency ranges and using that, whichever one appears to be most advantageous, let's say for the wireless carrier, and then picking that to produce the most advantageous search ring, for example, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I got two different thoughts. To sum this up, it's far too complex from an engineering switch electronic standpoint for somebody to say, oh, we want to use the lowest frequency, or we've been told you. for all these reasons discussed, it doesn't work that way. And I talked more about the engineering of the areas and how the switch makes handoffs and such and such. Paul, I guess it was, pointed out that certain frequencies will be used for certain applications, like let's say 700's data. Well, they can't use that if they're trying to expand their voice circuit, so we can't just say use 700 because it's the wrong stuff. You're wanting to do it because it covers the greater and the less amount of cell sites. Well, okay, your thought is applicable, but it's not applicable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Also, now, to get down to wording, is what we're talking about. If you're using it in the context of a current criteria to justify a search ring, then you are talking about their existing network system. If they come to you today and they're trying to justify why they want another search site, well, that would then be conforming to their existing system because they're building, expanding within their existing system. If tomorrow newer networks come, 700 now is the greatest, well, at that point they would have to justify that, and that would be whatever frequency that would be, probably lower. So that would come later. We can't enforce it now. So this takes care of it incrementally from a time base. To justify today, which would be what they're talking about, you know, what we want to do tomorrow, then we can't request each megahertz thing. Again, as when the future comes up and they want a new network, perhaps, then it could easily be a lower frequency, which at that point they would be entitled to do so. It would be to our advantage.
They have to convert.
Yeah, you know, okay. So to add to existing, we can't tell them what to do.
Okay. So for technical, now with more understanding, drop out the megahertz piece.
We're recommending cross off using each megahertz available to the applicant.
Correct.
Striking that.
Okay.
So they'll still have the search rings identified for the separate goals.
Got it.
Which is acceptable. We don't have any issue with that.
Yep.
And then that eliminates if there's an upgrade or something coming down the road, they'll still be able to do the job.
Yeah.
So that we also cut that out in number three, using the lowest megahertz, just
correct,
to show to get available to the applicant.
Yeah, it's just too complicated.
A coverage map from the most, they can still indicate, well, the megahertz is, well, it's going to be that. So that it just stops at co-location site.
Across that, using the lowest range.
Okay,
then that makes it acceptable.
Okay.
Seems
and then,
be, yeah,
then it's applicable.
Correct. What they're trying to do and what they have to do, because this is the way it is.
I would just get rid of the megahertz frequency range stuff because the local jurisdictions can't really tell the which frequency they can use or which they would prefer that the wireless carrier uses. They have a license put into that by the FCC. So
that's what we did.
Okay. So should that be in the preamble?
I want to make one comment regarding the goals, the 70, 80, 90% coverage goals. I've never run into language like that before, and I've worked in probably over 100 different jurisdictions and codes for wireless facilities. I'm not real sure how you would measure that, how you demonstrate that in a wireless application, unless some of you have some ideas on that. The closest I can come up with is, you know, you could show your antenna at three different heights, for example, and that would affect the coverage. But, you know, if you're within the coverage area, you're getting coverage. I don't know how you would demonstrate that you're providing coverage to 70, 80, or 90, because the number of your customers in that area is going to fluctuate. You have people traveling through. I don't know how you would measure if you're covering 80 or 90.
Yeah,
that whole thing comes from, it's more of a market-based measurement. You need, the wireless carriers are obligated to provide coverage to, let's say, 70% of the market, but the market is a huge geographic region. You can't really narrow it down to a cell tower or a cell site specific. I don't know how you would measure it on cell site specific.
True, and there's two aspects of that. Like you said, it's a market-based thing. The end user could be transient, moving around in their cars, driving through the area. You may have fixed locations in a house. So that's one aspect of the end user, how many of them are in an area. The other aspect of it, if you're dividing percentages, it would almost be like percentage of service, meaning for a given fixed customer in a location, is he only getting a data rate of 70% as promised, 90% as promised, because the signal's weaker, the slower his data will go. Well, how do you express that in percentage? For this guy? What about this guy?
No one knows. You couldn't be measured. You're not going to go house to house and say, well, are you getting 1.5 megs a night? Because that also breathes. Remember, I told you, the more people are on a site, the more it shrinks in. And the less people are, the more it grows out. So the populous base is a dynamic target. The breathing of the cell site is a dynamic target. And who, even if it was a fixed, you wouldn't know what percentage you get, what speed, based on just your distance. You cannot quantify it. Impossible. For those three reasons.
Hey, Steve. We have a staff person right next door. Can you?
It's just like when I play guitar. Remind me.
Okay.
Please, I don't take offense.
I'm reminding.
I'm reminding. Yes.
We can hear very well over the phone.
Make it hear pretty well over the phone.
So we got Paul or Jim and Steve both saying that there's no way to verify or control the 70 to 90%.
Well, what I'm trying to look at is there are situations in which you could co-locate that. The best co-location scenario gives you a certain amount of coverage. And maybe you've got a gap here. Okay, you've got this gap here. And this is the best co-location scenario. And that, you know, covers most of the gap. It doesn't cover all the gap, but it covers most of the gap, over 70% of the gap. And we've never really identified whether we're talking about geographical or numbers of people. So that's
or great. Amount of service.
So I would just look at what FCC, how they define it in their requirement that a company has to have 70% service in order to keep their license. So you can co-locate and you can fill a lot of the gap. Or if you put a tower right here, or right in the middle of the gap, then you get 100%. Okay, but if you co-locate, you get 80%. It's not as good, but 80%. So are we obligated? We are not obligated under the law to give them the new tower.
So how do we evaluate this?
Since you can't quantify it.
Along the highway, for example, I-5, and there's a gap in service, so people are dropping their calls as they travel through that gap. You only want to cover 70% of that gap, so you're still dropping service. I mean, what are you doing for your customers in that way? They're,
I don't want my customers talking on the phone.
We have to do balancing between our commitments to, you know, the cell phone users, which is all of us, and also the integrity of our community and how many towers, and it's a balancing
act. Oh, a visual thing, integrity. Is that what I'm hearing you say? Okay, moving on. So, if you said it's a balancing act, okay, you want to do it right the first time. If you're balancing on a high wire act, you want to do it right the first time. You only get one chance.
You do want to do it right the first
time.
That's right.
If you're going to build a half cost and cover 70
of the gap.
They just spent $1 million.
On a highway, you're going to spend a lot of money putting in this wireless facility, which doesn't really cover the gap. And what you're going to get is another wireless facility in another year or two or whatever to fill the rest of that gap.
The gaps will be going away.
You're going to get multiple. You're going to increase the number of wireless facilities in the area. If you're going to nickel and dime on filling up a gap,
that's right.
You're going to end up having multiple wireless facilities filling a gap, which maybe one could have done.
And check this out. Here's something else I've never said before, and I didn't really appreciate as much until I took my vacation. I just spent a month. I've been over parts of Canada. I've been upstate New York. I've been in some fairly, let's call it, sophisticated, well-educated, well-developed cities and urban areas, Penfield, New York, etc., adjacent to many universities and many companies like Kodak and such. Educated people. There are cell towers on buildings where they need to be. There are cell towers out in these rural areas at the end of a dirt road where they need to be. Those people are allowing and appreciating these people, these cell towers, to be more than it is being intended from the CAC. Now, I realize that you folks came early on and stated, our area is beautiful. The Alpha Gate's a special area. Well, you know what? I just went everywhere across the country, and everywhere is special. My point is that you guys are trying to exclude or preclude to a certain amount visual impacts. Yes, I agree. And I've seen a lot of these other people who are of a similar mindset, meaning they're walking human beings with an educated mind. And these cell towers in a lot of these places are well placed. In many cases, they're, what do you call it when you get a pine tree? What's the word? Somewhere wide out in the open. These people have done this before we have, and I'm giving a lot of respect to these people, having just spent on the continent and off the continent. I've got a little bit different point of view here today, coming back to this. You guys are no special than anybody else. So, now, that being said, also, if you force people to co-locate, this is something I didn't appreciate before until I saw some of these. If you force people to co-locate exclusively because of the gap, in spite of the gap, you're going to have a 150-foot monster because you've got to provide three vertical spaces for co-locs. Those things, camouflaged, aren't necessarily the most attractive. But you know what? When you had a 90-foot monopole with a given customer on it, camouflaged or otherwise, I didn't even see it through the trees. My point being, you're better off with multiple cell towers at 90 foot not demanding colo than some giant demanding colo that turns into a monster that you don't want because you don't want them everywhere. You can't win. See what I'm saying?
There's applications for both.
So I wanted to point that out. Don't be so scared of them because you're going to create a monster, a 150-foot colo monster.
Well, let's move forward because right now I don't see any way unless you can justify or give me something that says the identify the separate goals of 70, 80, and 90.
Yeah,
exactly. It, by design and by application, it seems to be a tough thing to do. So I would recommend that we strike that. Still keep the separate graphic representation of search rings.
They're not going to build it if they don't need it.
Yeah.
If they need it, we have to apply it. So there's three different categories. Again, neither can be totally quantified. So it's a real rough go. We can't ask for the impossible.
There's something about just wanting a little more information on the basis that they use to create.
You are clear to research, and I'll tell you what I can.
That'll be in the application. Or
well, no, we're not asking for, I mean, without that, we're not asking for anything about.
I see what you're saying.
What determines a search ring? We know it's going to be the highest megahertz in the system because they have to use all the megahertz in the system.
Here's what I've seen. When I go to these hearings in the past, when these cell site people want to put systems in, they will show a map and they will show an overlay of existing sites and they will show you signal strength at those existing parameters or perimeters. Now, signal strength can be interpreted as to performance of service. If you're only getting, 90% of your signal, you get 90% of your data speed or whatever. Anyway, there's contours out there. Those are shown at a hearing. Now, the areas that aren't in green that have coverage aren't being covered. That's the gap. You come to the meeting, you look at the map, you go, boy, I don't get out there at all. Solution, they need it. You're really trying to make things way more complicated than in some cases. And I appreciate that, but we need to, like, I'm coming back with a little bit renewed vigor here, and information and willingness and all that. And again, it would be an existing green contour. There's the surface area. There's no green here. Well, that's why they need it. And they put it in.
Okay. I'm not sure that you're asking for anything other than that.
Yeah.
So I don't understand if we can't apply it and we can't judge it or gauge it, how do we put it in?
That's the issue that needs more.
Yeah, you've made it clear to me, James and Dave, you've made it clear to me that we can ask for things that we can't quantify or identify. You know, I'm learning things here. And we can't for three reasons. Just can't do it.
So I said we strike the identify the separate goals approximately 70, 80, 90% coverage. So from identified to the end of that sentence.
Yeah, come and look at the map. You know,
they're going to have the map. They're going to have the... And we have maps on the wall, which we're going to talk about in a little bit for Paul and Jim, too, of the buffer differences. We'll go over that because we've got three different maps with three different buffer capabilities when we get into the setback issue.
Mm-hmm. So the issue then would be, for the planning department, the issue then would be for the independent consultant to explore if it moved out of the search rings that were given to us in the application, how well would that actually cover the gap?
Yeah, I'm having a rough time with that, too. I'm not sure where that's trying to be going.
So what you're saying is if they do a presentation and they come in with an application and have a set specific area A is where we plan on doing it, and you're saying they come back in and say we're going to do area B now instead of area A?
No, what I'm saying is because I've seen search ring maps. So, for example, the search ring map I have, you know, they were saying this is our gap that we want to cover.
Right.
And they were saying we could put a tower anywhere in this area, or this area.
Right. And that's pretty standard in the application.
Right.
I have a question.
So what's the question?
Water finish.
So I'm assuming that for the company's purposes, they want to make sure that this completely covers the whole gap. Well, and I may just be repeating myself, because you're right, I don't know exactly how we could measure that. You know, if there's already a tower over here, you know, and if they put it there, it would cover that. You know, but it would leave that out. That's what
I'm looking. So you're putting a portion at them, but they're going to come in with the application as to what's best going to fit the needs.
Their needs.
Well, that's the whole purpose of them putting the tower.
I know.
Their needs.
Well, yeah, and what I'm saying is, you know, so if these search rings represent new towers, and what they haven't expressed, but of course it's true, is they want to cover perfectly the whole thing that they think is a gap. But co-locating over here would cover this much.
Well, then this is a problem.
And that would have to be justified in the application.
Well, if this covers to here and this isn't being covered, that's a problem.
No. This is the area that's not being covered. Okay, this is
That's the current gap.
It won't work that way. If there's a tower here, the gap is going to exist like this. All of this is going to be the gap. It doesn't work like that.
No, but there are other towers. It's not
there may not be. This is the county. We don't know if there is or isn't. I'm not going to assume otherwise. From a given tower, it won't cover beyond a certain range.
There are towers over here,
Do you know that?
Well, we're not talking about a specific. I'm sort of talking about a specific situation where they said, "Is this the gap we want to cover?"
It won't look like that typically. If there's no, okay, there may be towers out there where this is good, and there may indeed be a gap. There may.
Right.
Well, if those towers didn't cover the gap, there's got to be another one. If this one doesn't cover the gap, there's got to be another one. How is there a discussion? And let me ask you this. If there's towers all over the... How is this area, or this area, or this area where there might be, could be, towers, going to be any different to you, me, or the squirrel? It's all our world. You're trying to, like, massage them into a corner and stuff. That corner is just as viable as down the street. It's all our world. So you're trying to locate them in a sense that one is better than the other? Not if there's a gap. It's all important. So if I don't look at it, you're going to look at it. If you don't look at it, the next guy's going to be looking at it. No matter where you put them, there's going to be impact. So it becomes less concerned to me where you put them because there's no more or less impact. It's just somewhere else.
So it's kind of varied, depending. And every situation is going to be different. But
you see the point that I'm making.
Yes.
Co-location might work, but that's not going to be mentioned at all in the search rings because the search rings is only looking at what can cover every single
thing. But that's going to be justified in the application.
Yeah.
And do we need to do anything to demand that they do it a different way versus what they're trying to do? I mean, I see that.
Okay, number three might take care of that. A coverage map from the most effective potential, the most effective co-location site. So they have to give us a coverage map. They have to pick the closest co-location site and show us what that would cover.
Wireless facility site plan approval criteria on page 13 of the draft. Under 2 is justification of need and location. So you're talking about the difference between mounting a new tower versus co-location. I think if you, in combination with what you've just stated, we've also got shows on the map, and we do have all the cell towers mapped in the county. Shows on that map. You know, you have to justify the new one. So you've really got two steps there. One is
going
to
be
show us what kind of coverage have you got with towers you could co-locate on now,
mm-hmm.
where co-location possibilities
mm-hmm.
exist, Because there may be a tower
okay.
there, but
I'm
it may
okay.
not have any more room.
Okay. So that would be number
the justification
two.
Justification kind of backs up the other.
So number two would be topographic representations of search rings
correct.
For service proposed.
Just search rings. They're going to do
oh, we have this defined. It's defined.
That's
yeah.
correct. So
okay.
just end everything
okay.
in search rings.
Okay.
And three is going to go from A coverage to co-location site and end of site.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. And then that's going to cover everything.
That's something on number two.
That's why we're kind of lost in what you were looking for, and I was trying to understand it. But they're going to do that in the application.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the definition that they have to go need versus want.
Number three,
and
it's
number
still
three
going to
is just here.
So, and what I think you're looking for, the justification.
This is okay.
Okay, so let's move forward.
Thank you.
Okay. Next on the agenda. Setback maps.
Are you sure you want to hit this one yet?
Sure.
Yep.
We got maps on the wall. Let's look at them.
Yeah.
We wanted to review these. James had our GIS guy, Cody Zuck, and if you want to stand up and get a closer
look. Paul and Jim, we've got three different maps on the wall. One's a 250-foot buffer, one's a 750-foot buffer, and the other one's a 1,500. And we talked about the 1,500 in a previous meeting about how much it limits the capabilities.
I'm not sure how big the file sizes are of these things, and they're a little big to be scanning and sending to you, so.
They're 36 inch, so.
Anyway, this is a 250 foot buffer, and the buffers are around residences.
Wow. Okay.
And then the same with the 750-foot buffer around residences.
Ooh, ouch.
And 1,500-foot buffer. The residences that are depicted on these maps are from
1,005.
Five.
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 I think it was
so
five.
So
that's,
what,
6 years out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so quite a few more.
So we've got more homes since these, but this is the best data we've got on our aerial photographs.
All right. Well, I'm going to go first. My opinion is such that given a cell coverage area might only be in the matter of several miles or such, that if you get into this kind of a map, the 750, some of your distances outside of those areas wouldn't be covering the populous centers in those areas.
How do you know that?
Based on the coverage of cellulars, in typically a matter of miles. And depending on the height of the tower, if you're 150-foot monster, we'll go a little bit further. But with our terrain and foliage and limited RF power at the higher frequencies, which everybody around here uses, that's what I'm basing on it, 30 years of education, to answer your question.
So, and these maps are, you know, each of the ones with a number in the middle, that's a section, so that's a square mile.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. Well, okay then. So, if you'll obviously have something, let's say here, a square mile, we could expect a several mile radius. So it would get into the populous areas.
Several miles, that's two boxes, right? I mean, at least several is more than...
No, I'm talking the small boxes.
Oh, small boxes, okay.
A square mile, that's
the okay.
tiny square.
Yeah, this is a 10 by 10. Oh, square box, these little guys.
The little
well, then you can see the necessary to be able to put cell sites close, so there's no point in putting them at all, in which we can't preclude them. So I vote we go with a 250-foot buffer and 1,000-foot for hospitals and schools.
Just give Paul and Jim a reference. We have a map.
It's 36
roughly,
miles.
Yeah,
that's a country.
I don't know. A map in grids, and the grids are 36 square miles per grid. So what Steve is referencing, that if you put it, and due to the restrictions of the distance from the tower and the terrain of the territory, if you put it too far out of the grid, you defeat the purpose of having the tower, because the tower needs to be where the populace has access to it, or there's no sense having it.
So therefore, if you put it out in the forest, it won't work. If you push it down the street, you just push it into somebody else's backyard. I don't see the point.
Tell me when you're ready for me to speak.
And then the 750 and 1,500-foot maps, we're just showing the buffer here. What we're not showing is any adjustments to the buffer because of the residential waiver provision that we've talked about. We haven't looked at any particular uses in there. Cody did not go through and put any particular buffers on
parks, hospitals,
schools, things like that. The layer that we had to go off of was residences, because there's more of those in the county than anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And most hospitals and parks and schools are surrounded by houses anyway, so
and
they pretty much get folded in.
1,500 square feet, the whole county.
And I'd also like to point out that this is an aerial view, which makes it seem transparent, meaning it does not, unless you get up and study this, the topographical imagery, you can't even really appreciate the blockage of the mountains, hills, and terrain. And it certainly does nothing to say for the trees and the foliage. This is an independent, this is a transparent best-case scenario, which is not even reflecting real coverage on the ground because, again, of terrain which you can study on the topo imagery or the trees. So it's far worse than appears on the map, as far as coverage is concerned.
Okay. Shivana, go ahead.
So first I want to preface this by, this issue is the number one in the whole ordinance priority for the CAC. This is the issue. This is why we're here.
We've all known that. Okay. Let her speak, would you?
Certainly. We also, listening to the comments that were made at other sessions, we have a rewritten proposed section, which is number 7 of the handout that you got, within which several compromises have already been made. We reduced the 1,500 to 1,200. We dropped out hospitals and rehabilitation centers. We dropped out public places. We dropped out things from that group. We may have made some other suggestions also. As we look at this, this is theoretical. First of all, the way we wrote it now, it makes sure that there will be coverage because it has the two ways that there can be a variance. And the second way is, if they can't get the coverage for the gap, then they could reduce the setback to the reduce it by the minimum or to the maximum, whatever, you know, reduce it as little as possible, but reduce it to where the coverage can be gotten. On the ground, where I think the real information is Lane County, which has a 1,200-foot setback, and I have spoken to Raphael Senna, who is a planner at Lane County, and asked, they have geographically the same kind of terrain that we do, and I have said, with your 1,200-foot setback, are you having a problem citing these towers to get the coverage? They have the waiver in place. And he said, no, we are not having a problem. Everything else is theoretical. But this offers a way out if there is a problem. You know, and, yeah, I mean, that's most of what I want to say.
All right, then I'll go ahead. I don't know a lot about Lane County, but
Let me say I'm still stuck.
Okay,
I just
want
a little moment.
You said
you were done, so
okay,
sorry.
Okay,
but just a breath.
So,
you're not in 24 hours today, okay?
I'm way ahead of you. Look, tell me what they say is in Lane County.
It is Eugene.
Okay, let's just stay with that. Eugene is going to have a more progressive mindset due to an industrial, progressive nature of city times of life. You folks are from the Applegate and are 100% 180.
This is not,
Steve, to put it in perspective, Lane County goes from the coast of Oregon at Florence all the way up to the crest of the Cascades.
So there's a lot of rural as well.
Yeah.
Of those rural areas,
Lane County is pretty unique in the fact that it's got the second largest city in the state of Oregon, and it's got some of the most least populated areas, too. So
okay.
I think it's to characterize Lane County in one particular way is just impossible to do.
Let me take another stab at a generalization that I may be dead wrong at. The bulk of the populace is probably in the bigger cities, as the populace of a whole of the county.
Correct.
Sure. More so than, say, other places, because those worlds get real rural. There's very little from anything to the coast. And then you have the coast, which is a 300-foot strip of homes, more or less. You know, the coast is a narrow strip. There's not much populace there. It's the core of the big cities. Big city people think, they do, they think different, a lot of them will be, than, say, the rural zones, because of the visibility. They don't have as much to protect from a visual standpoint as perhaps we do in a rural area.
But this is the city of Eugene. This is the county of Lane.
Exactly. Right, which we just defined the bulk of the populace is probably in the city. Anyway, my point being...
Well, hold on.
Okay, I'm holding.
As a jurisdictional planner in the county of Josephine, I can tell you that my ordinance doesn't mean anything in the city of Grants Pass. And that's Shavana's point. That's Shavana's point.
Eugene has their own ordinance.
Right.
Stricter than the county.
Because they're the city, right, not the county.
Good
right.
Point.
I didn't include that.
You had something
excellent.
You wanted to finish on.
Excellent. Go ahead.
The only thing is a larger thing, and it's kind of just that, you know, we have a responsibility as a county, because that's who we are here, you know, to serve our people, you know. And our people want different things. They want cell phone coverage, and they also want, you know, visual aesthetics, and they also want property values, which is another issue, you know, that we have yet to discuss further. The way we've written this, this does not prohibit service. If we prohibited service, if we made it impossible, we'd be violating the TCA, so we can't do that. This gives two variance options, and in the second variance, the B, basically says we can prohibit service, so this can be reduced if it needs to be. The only hard evidence that I know, hard evidence about how much of our population, you know, wants the cell antennas. Was there a miss something?
No, I'm going to change something.
Okay. Oh, yeah, get that out. The only hard evidence that I know of, and if any of you know of anything else, in terms of how much of our population wants the cell towers in their backyard or in their neighborhood because they want the best service they can possibly get, and how much of our population wants at least as much distance from the towers.
Let's answer this question then.
I have two pieces of hard evidence.
Okay.
That's what I was getting to.
Yeah, but let's hard evidence the county. We're going to have an open house. Let's put that to the populace. Let's get the opinion. Because I think I agree with Steve. I think 1,200 is too big. I think it should be lower. But I think if we're going to open houses, then let's put, okay, here is the restrictions, or here's the coverage at this range, and here's the coverage at this range, and let's, when we have our open house.
But it doesn't restrict coverage. That's okay with me, you know. But what I think is it doesn't restrict coverage. It's the argument that it's too big because it's going to restrict coverage. It doesn't restrict coverage, but it says if you can't do it, that's our goal. And if you can't do it, then it's smaller.
Okay, I realize the point you're trying to make now is there's a back door. But I'm still going to point out two things. One is that if you can't put it here, you're just going to squeeze it somewhere else. You know, if it's not your backyard, it's going to be somebody else's backyard. And who's to say what is right? There is no wrong. Or there's no right or wrong. I mean, it's just going to push it to somebody else's area. So, also, you say moments ago, we've made compromises. You've made, what was the term? Maybe it was compromises. Well, you know, I don't see this as a compromising environment. If you allow this and that you don't necessarily agree on the compromise table, you just made it worse for somebody else to get it the way you want. I don't like that either. This has been a give and take game. I don't see it as that. There's nothing, that's not fair to whoever got less or more based on what you wouldn't have given if you didn't have to trade something off. It doesn't work that way. That's not right.
Put it on hold for a minute. Let's move forward.
Anyway.
I'm still in agreement that 1,200 is too high. That's my opinion. And we're going to make some decisions on that. And probably if the Planning Commission has to make that decision and not here, then we'll do that.
My wife made a good point. A lot of people resent being told what to do with their own private property.
Yeah, we know that.
Some people would like to have the income. Some people would like to have it there or wouldn't mind. Some might put it here and save it because it's better here looking than over there. Well, the uglier. There's just too much at stake.
Okay.
You can't even say visual here or there. It's a given. It might be a great bunch of trees by that house. I weren't perfect.
We got it.
No?
Okay. Take a breath.
This is Paul. If I could speak.
Go ahead.
This is Paul. I do see the compromise that they've made in here with a list of land uses which they would like to propose the 100 foot setback from. However, it looking at it, it looks like it appears that it's RF RIV, and they're trying to avoid, you know, they're trying to regulate radio frequencies, which is, as we know, is a, you know, a violation of the Telecom Act. Without some sort of, and I acknowledge there are some exceptions here, but without some sort of exception for, let's say, visual impact. So if you could build in some exceptions for stealth facilities or facilities which take advantage of like existing screening, reduce these setbacks. This is clearly a radio frequency driven regulation here, setback, which would be a violation, especially because visual impact setbacks make sense from residential dwellings and perhaps parks, but from public and private schools and daycare facilities, I don't understand how you could justify a 1,500-foot setback based on visual impacts or you know, to preserve the beauty of the area, for example. But the way this is written, it sounds pretty clear that this is a radio frequency-driven setback where you're trying to limit radio frequency emissions, perhaps.
The reality, however, is that that exact issue has been taken to court, and the city, each time the court has upheld that the city had perfect right to legislate in this way.
Yeah, they can legislate setbacks, but they need to justify those setbacks.
No, I don't think that's accurate.
How are these setbacks being justified?
I don't think that that's actually accurate. I don't know if you're...
Maybe David could speak to this, but it's my understanding the county can't come up with a regulation without some sort of justification or explanation for where that regulation is coming from.
I would agree with that. We have to justify most everything we do.
If it involves an exaction, Paul, and I think, are you referring to the nexus and rough proportionality standard of Dolan v. Tigard?
I didn't have that in mind, no.
Okay.
I'm familiar with it, though.
Okay. Well, to justify an exaction, yes, the county does have to provide a nexus between the exaction and the, you know, the protection of a resource or the mitigation of an impact, and yet that mitigation has to be roughly proportional, according to Dolan. But other regulations that the county might enact, it has to be consistent with your comprehensive plan, but that's about where the justification stops. And if your comprehensive plan says that we're going to have a visually gorgeous Josephine County and we're going to limit the number of cell towers because of that, it doesn't need to go into much more detail than that.
And
whether it be, you know, under a general health, safety, and public welfare standard, we do have that to say or to address as well.
Yeah.
Which is in the and that's what makes the TCA so unusual, is that it does reach farther than most statutes in allowing something and then addressing a particular issue which would generally be covered under health, safety, and welfare.
Yeah.
So
let's say the comp plan did have something talking about preserving the beauty of the area and stuff, then you would think that there would be built into this language somehow where you could get a reduction of the setback if you take advantage of existing screening or stealthing or something like that.
For the visual impact portion of it, yes.
Yeah.
That applies to a building, but doesn't do anything to antennas on a tower, unless you're talking camouflage, and that's the term we should use, if that's what we're talking about.
Yes.
I mean, situations could be there's a large stand of tall trees, or there's an existing building, or there's a ridge line or something where you could hide the tower up against that.
While I understand that the setback limitation is the most important issue to the CAC, in thinking of how the different standards that we're talking about, we've got setbacks that limit where towers go, we've got visual impacts that limit where towers go, we've got other standards, what other opportunities are there to co-locate antennas, all those things in concert with each other can provide some limitation and some direction to staff when writing a permit on where that tower can be located. So it's not just setbacks, it's the other things as well.
Yeah.
If the setback limitation can be met by a tower that happens to be, you know, right in front of the visual impact of a major, a tourist lodge or something like that, I think we've got other standards that are going to come into play and move that tower out of the visual impact zone.
I guess I'm
relatively comfortable with the setback limitation as written, with the exception of public and private school and licensed daycare facility. But I think the other ones,
yeah,
we are talking about visual standards and impacts to residential dwellings, public and private park. And what I would be more concerned about, though, is that a setback limitation be listed, even though setbacks are generally one of those black and white objective standards we've talked about before, we're using criteria in other portions of the ordinance, and I'm wondering if setback limitations couldn't also be, even though it's not traditional to do so, that they could be addressed in criteria rather than a firm setback limitation.
That could be.
Because 1,200 feet may not be adequate if you're looking right at it.
Mm-hmm.
You can have it.
If you have a lesser setback, but have it not in the view shed of homes and have them, 500 feet, but it's behind them.
See, so
then maybe that's better.
I've seen
that with stealth, and you're taking advantage of existing screening and stuff like that. That might get that.
I don't have a sub criteria I can throw out as an example at this point, but I'm starting to look at it a little differently because this almost reads like a criteria. Here's a standard you start with, and if you can't meet that, there are some other things that you can justify to reduce it from there, which is, we're not going to use the V word.
Oh.
Variances mean something very specific to planners.
Okay.
This is an exception or a reduction or an amendment to the setback.
Okay.
We have a whole section of the code called variance.
Okay.
That's a different standard. That's the one wordsmithing portion.
Okay. So the words, yeah.
Can I say even if this passes, relatively intact, we'll take out the word variance.
We're done with that topic, but I also noticed.
I think Steve had a comment on that topic.
Paul had something.
Okay.
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I just wanted to ask about paragraph 2B and these revisions talking about, like, once again, we're talking about 70% coverage and lowest megahertz range.
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't sure if we'd addressed that yet. Or
we just hadn't stricken it on the record yet, but I did strike it through Siobhana and we were amenable since we've already agreed to that in the previous.
I didn't want to confirm that was done. Right.
Yeah, that has to come out, like we agreed in the previous one.
Okay. Steve?
Well, I want to emphasize, I talked to Lane County Planner, the same Raphael, the same one she did, for quite a bit of time. And the emphasis that he repeatedly came back to is the only thing that really that made their setback work was a waiver system. If you have a waiver system where people can pick and choose, yes, I want it, or no, I don't want it, that's where they have such a great success rate, a high percentage of placement, because they have that waiver system.
Right, without the exceptions.
Without the prohibiting service.
1,200 is prohibiting service.
Yeah.
It's non-functional. Right. Doesn't work.
Well, it's against the TCA if you don't have the
exceptions.
Well, my biggest concern is it's difficult for these cell carriers to find a appropriate, and that faces a lot of things. Visual setbacks, coverage. It's very difficult for them to find a worthwhile location. The two told me, they search high and low. And as Dave pointed out, there might be some really nice places to put it that are visually desirable. And I would just hate to squeeze so many locations out that we preclude them. I realize it's a waiver, but I'm just saying, I would hate to preclude them from not being able to go to some ideal locations. Because that's really what needs to be found here, is ideal locations to make everybody happy. And if they get squeezed out by a large buffer, I realize there's this waiver deal, but they'd have to go pick choose. It could get, almost impossible, is if there's more options for them to choose from that are aesthetically pleasing, then everybody might be more pleased in the long run. That's kind of how I'm looking at it. They would have more choices to be right over here where this clump of trees and the little hill is, and we don't even see it. And I want to make sure one thing. when we're talking aesthetics, visibility, it's my opinion that the tower itself, monopole, camouflage, though, is the biggest concern. The facilities of the ground shouldn't be too much of an issue. They could, as some of the pictures that were sent to us by email that I got, I guess you all got, they could look like a barn, they could look like an outhouse, they could look like anything, an outbuilding. So what's on the ground shouldn't be as much of a concern. The tower certainly is. And that's why I'm more desirable to see them be able to put in locations that could be beneficial to get that tower more obscured instead of precluded from even those spots. That's kind of how I'm looking at it.
Okay. Dave, did you have something?
No.
Okay.
Just a thought that we have to take out, we would have to take out this.
The bottom line, yes.
Yes, the bottom line.
The 70% of
the... That allows the gap to be filled, that drops out
on
the very end.
Okay. For the moment, we have a, on two, setback limitations. We want to strike private, public license, take care of...
Oh, no. We have not agreed to that. No.
Trying to answer right now. That's what my question was.
All right, so further discussion.
Thank you.
Okay. So we have, again, dissent among the ranks on the, one, where is the 1,200 coming from, and two, the capability of enforcing.
Okay.
So I don't see that really happening today, to getting a comfort level with that. Is there, let me think of how to word this question, Paul or Jim, is there language you know of that generically, is there a set language that addresses that setback issue? Or is every jurisdiction just completely different from everybody else?
For how they measure setbacks for...
Correct.
Every jurisdiction is...
How a setback's measured?
But a pretty common one in counties, for example, is...
We have a...
100% height setback for towers, so whatever the height of the tower is, it's set back from the property line. So 100-foot tower would be set back 100 feet.
Well, I'm more... Are you talking about how we measure a setback?
No, well, I'm
a
more...
A lot more the standard for...
It's in our code.
Yeah, no, my question... Let me rephrase the question, because specifically, I would reference the same question in reference to the child care or the school or public or private school. Because I know... Every school, SOU, U of O, OSU, all have antennas on campus.
Well, probably not.
Oh, they do.
Okay.
Oregon Caves have a cell tower site right next to the Shilwat, or the lodge. So, I'm not sure how I'm trying to word this question, but we're trying to, the CAC is trying to exclude all of these, and I think some of them are, especially a private school, is going to want service, not be precluded from service.
Yeah, these specific uses rarely come up in a code, rarely.
But they do. I mean,
these for daycare facilities, I've never seen that come up in a wireless code. I don't know that I've seen, well, yeah, schools in Lake County, but rarely, but there's special setback standards for those uses.
What about parks?
Rarely again. I mean, usually county codes don't have special setback requirements for certain uses. Other than residential is pretty common, that's understandable. Parks, maybe, none that come to mind. But a lot of it is visual impact limits. I mean, I'm aware of a code which they want to reduce the visual impacts from parks and from public trails and from the freeway that runs through town. But that's addressed, as well as residences.
I can give
schools
you...
Schools and daycare facilities, I've never seen that one come up.
Yeah.
Schools, barely.
Yeah.
Well, see parks more often than schools.
Yeah.
Well, regarding daycares, are you suggesting, Shivana, that the young children are more concerned about seeing it than a group of adults, which is what defines a daycare in the first place? Because there's more kids.
That's why I'm concerned with RF-driven language.
I'm not going to respond to that, and I'm only going to say that one of the laws that has, again, I'd like you to look at the things I dropped out. not just the ones that I left in, but the amount ones that we dropped out. And one of the laws, in a spirit of compromise, I left out public buildings was even in there.
I don't feel compromise is a fair thing, so I don't like to address that either.
Okay.
So you're shoving it on somebody else. It's not fair.
Paul still sees it as RF-driven. I still see it as RF-driven. So I have concerns, but we're not going to be able to answer that in this subcommittee.
And maybe I should get more information on the court case that I know of that had this language that was taken to court and won.
My comments on that, those courts exist. Courts exist around here. If something ends up going to court, so be it. But I don't see a set of precedents, perhaps. Maybe, I don't know if I want to call it a trend. I don't know. Systems are in place, just why you're trying to recreate systems now. It's just another leg of the work.
Yes. I think positions are pretty much cemented where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
And the committee is going to have to come up with some sort of recommendation. So
yeah.
I don't know if you, Ron, you've only got three members of your committee here. I don't know if you want to call for votes or whatever, or how you want to do that. I think that you can throw an option out there, and the Planning Commission can see a couple of different versions with justification of each. When this goes to the Planning Commission, the staff, James and I, are going to need to write a staff report that evaluates some of this and explains sort of the general construct of the wireless ordinance and what it addresses, what it can and can't address, so the Planning Commission has that background. What the general concerns of the subcommittee are, and that's what a meeting in the near future, and I hope we're not going to have too many more of these meetings, for everyone's sake, but one of the meetings that we'll need to get from the subcommittee, we're kind of step back kind of to the basics of where this all came from, which is what drives us to have a wireless communications ordinance. We want protection of the view shed. We want to not have a technology sort of interface all the time, but at the same time something that's provided that people can use. And what are the things that are driving the different elements of this? We want clear standards for the wireless industry to meet. We want ordinance could be understood by the public when we're writing a permit, so they know what to expect when they move. They buy a lot in a subdivision or a lot in a rural area. What can they reasonably expect in terms of coverage and their view shed to not be compromised? So I mean, those kind of things we'll need to get to. But part of what we'll need to explain to the Planning Commission is when it comes to some of these standards where we picked a number. Or we've picked a scenario of getting to a number. What was the philosophy behind that?
We're going to have a justification,
right? And Paul, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I think that's kind of addressing what you were asking about.
Yeah, thanks for
is that going to cover it? I mean, I think we do need to have a pretty good reason why we're coming up with standards. Well, the comp plan is a rather general set of goals that we're trying to meet, and I think there's a lot of leeway within that. But and not everyone has to like the particular reason that the subcommittee has.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to be able to identify what the reasons are.
And that's what I've been learning here. I've decided in many, many meetings now, and a lot of this type of the process is totally new to me. And this isn't the only hearing I've been sitting in, as you guys well know. I'm learning a lot about how the system works, what's expected of the planning department. And a lot of these things are absolutes. You have to, as you just spent 5 minutes explaining. So I'm trying to posture myself more in a position to function effectively within the guidelines that the structure in place demands or expects of me. If we can't justify 90%, any of those numbers don't exist. If we're trying to, and now we're down to visual. Visual is a very arbitrary area, and we're down to that. So that's why I ask the outright questions. Are kids more concerned about the view than the adults? How otherwise can I address certain things that don't have absolutes? If we're going to, I'm not going to be an ass and say it regardless of RF. I'm asking absolutes and visuals because that's what we're trying to deal with. I'm trying to come here and be real factual anymore and real
beneficial anymore, and you know, more so, I should say.
We got it.
So, well, I know, but we have to work. I'm just saying, we all have to work. These guidelines are going to just go. It won't work.
I'm going to set it. We're going to make a vote on it next meeting. I would probably do it today, except we're missing a lot of bodies. I'd prefer to have the other bodies here and get input and make sure that we're all on the same page.
Okay.
If we're going to have a justification of a foot, then we need to have a justification why.
Okay.
It's RF based, and I don't think it needs to be that way.
I would propose this for your next meeting, if you're going to all suggest this to the chair. To have under setback, to kind of have, you know, 2-3 options, whatever they may be, that the committee can read separately. I think what Siobhan has presented here is a good option in its own right.
The basis.
Yes. And I think maybe the original one that we have in the draft ordinance, and then this option, and then, Ron, do you want to draft an option? A third option?
I can do some.
That's a suggestion.
You know,
and then just have those options separate. Rather than wordsmithing time after time, we have option 1, 2, and 3. And have the committee just, you know, look at those, study each of them separately, and come up with those. And they can decide whether they want to go forward to the planning commission with one of those options, or maybe suggest all three.
Okay.
The one thing that confuses me, and maybe Paul on the phone can address this a little bit, is that, like, when you talk about, you know, what's the story with the schools, and I would come the other way. What is so important to you about not having the school thing in there? I don't understand why it's so important.
Let me ask you this first. Do you have any kids, teenagers right now?
But we're not talking about preventing service to the school. We're not talking about preventing service.
A large setback around schools will affect a large area around the school. Obviously there's other uses around the school, whether it's rural or you have some industrial, commercial, residential, which need to have wireless service. And by pushing wireless facilities 1,200 feet away from schools, you could limit the number, the ability to provide wireless service to those surrounding uses near the school.
But we can't, if we do that, we can't. We can't, if it actually prohibits service to those uses, then Clause B comes into thing. Then it has to be, you know, we can't prohibit service. We know we can't prohibit service. So it's not about prohibiting service. It's just about keeping it a little bit further away. Just the location.
Okay.
So I
fully agree. I'm sensitive to the fact that no one wants to. If there's an area where public gathers, parks, schools, those types of places, I agree. No one should want to see a 150-foot colo monster, which we're pushing for. And I still have a problem with that because it's going to be a 150-foot colo monster square one. Well, that's the desired preference. I agree. So I'm perfectly willing to have some degree of setback around publicly gathered locations. And I think if they're 1,000 or 1,200 foot back, that you're probably still getting a pretty darn good coverage. They have to put some antennas that have additional gain in that direction. So from the aesthetic aspect, you know, I hate to use the word compromise, but it makes sense to me to not force 150-foot colo down a public place where they gather. So I can't come up with a number. I mean, I started off really at the map. I'm all for 250 on residences. I'll go 1,000 feet on, you know, schools and stuff, because they shouldn't have to be subjected to a 150-foot colo monster.
If we want to go with the subparagraph B, then we need to have a waiver for the school, because right, the subparagraph B, as I'm reading it, you can obtain, you need to demonstrate good faith efforts have been made to obtain waivers from residents, owners, to allow siding to fill the gap. That doesn't really address schools necessarily. What if there aren't any residences that are getting in the way? It's the school.
Okay. Well, I
got it.
Like I say, Siobhan, if you want to sort of
take the comments you've heard today, mm-hmm. make any revisions to your that preferred option, if you will.
Mm-hmm. I got that, Paul.
Okay, thank you.
And bring that back. Ron, do you want to work on a...
We'll work something up that's generic for the county.
Okay, and I would suggest that for each option that you come up with, the language that you're proposing and maybe a paragraph that just explains its justification.
Okay.
That would be my suggestion.
And, but you're talking about, we're talking about for when we finally submit.
For the next meeting. So take what you've done here under G, setback limitation, massage that, change it, whatever you feel is necessary out of what you've heard today, and then come back at the next meeting with the language and then a paragraph that just explains the justification for that.
For the setbacks.
That's
and I'd like to point out, as far as schools are concerned, with the increased amount of natural disasters, which have been significant, and the heaven forbid, what do you want to call it? Someone goes in, you know, guns in schools, and you know,
schools for
terrorists. But the communications, the contact, the cellular networks, evacuations, all has become even increasingly desirable in public places.
We're not talking about prohibiting service. We're not talking about
Paul mentioned if they were far enough back, it could possibly preclude good service inside a structural building because you lose signal inside. Elevators, basements.
Okay, so we're going to move forward to item C on the agenda, property values.
Oh, sorry. Table that one. It's another big one. I mean, but...
4:30, you want to table it?
Can we table that one?
Okay, we'll table it, but that's kind of the same thing. We've already had some presentations and some stuff in front of us, so we need to get that settled, and that will be settled at the next meeting.
Okay. Thank you.
So we're going to hit the setbacks first and finalize that.
All right.
Move forward with a direction, and we will vote on it and have a direction to move forward on. And property values will be the same thing. I would expect to have a vote and move forward on property values next week, so next meeting.
But I like
Item D is something I asked Anna to put on the agenda. Decision on highlighted text of the ordinance. And so if you could go through the draft, level September 14th draft, and where I've got highlights. Now on page 5, we already addressed those highlights. On 7,
we're still on setbacks.
On
I
that.
Still see that as
okay.
being squared away next week, next meeting.
Right, and do we also want to? I want to delve into setbacks again, but item number 3 there on page 7. We do have a process of evaluating impact historic and archaeological sites already in the code.
Okay.
So
it's a 1,300 feet in the code, or is that something we need to worry about?
What I'm thinking of is, do we want to establish, I'm just going to throw a question out there, we can discuss it next time. Do you want to establish a setback to historic places and structures or archaeological sites, or do you want to establish a distance if you are within one of those sites? You've satisfied the other setback criteria, and now you're within 900 feet of an archaeological site. And, or we've got a 1,300-foot buffer, let's say. If you're within the buffer, do we kick it to our normal process for notification of historical archaeological sites, or do you want a real setback?
I'd say we kick it to the normal process. It's an archaeologist dig, it's not going to have any effect with the cell tower, as well as it's camouflage.
That will probably be an option that James and I can work on, and that's something will come up unique to setback limitation number 3.
Without question, I don't think anyone on this table wants it 150 poles sticking in and staring us in the eyes, but a camouflage.
What might an archaeological site be, for instance, in this county?
A burial site.
No.
Rocks?
No. Archaeological.
You heard it at the meeting the other night.
Yeah, we had some.
Right. The Oregon Trail.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what was brought up there.
Yeah, the Trail. Yeah.
Well, okay.
What purpose of restricting it from a trail is going to have any effect on practicality?
Well, because no one
uses it. I don't know where that came from. Was that a visual thing?
I think it came out of another ordinance. I think it just came out of another
ordinance. I would say, number one, it must be camouflaged and blended or whatever term you wish to use.
With no distance thing at all?
Well, you can have some distance, but really,
I guess
from a dig.
What I'm saying,
well, archaeological. I'm sort of thinking historical.
The burial site. What do you got? The museum.
Unless
not a lot of those in the
unless
town.
No.
So the reason the buffer around known archaeological sites to peel back the onion a layer and look a little deeper, so to speak.
That it really might be.
Is that and the reason to do that is that. Most archaeological sites go in patterns, they go along river drainages, they're close to historic wetlands, they're related to each other. When you find one and you have other criteria such as distance to water, historic wetlands, view shed areas, you know, the Native Americans like a good view too, and the same criteria for their real estate. Usually you'll find those sites relate to each other. So if you're within 200 feet of an archaeological site, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to be possibly impacting one where you're going to locate a tower. So I would suggest something like a buffer around those sites. And if you're within that buffer, then we could require a cell tower to do an archaeological site assessment, which is the first level of a... You're not doing a full-blown study. That's usually an archaeologist goes out there, looks at the site, does a few shovel probes.
They probably won't choose it in the first place knowing that. They'll probably avoid it at all costs, and they're usually remote and wouldn't need to be there, perhaps.
There's a lot of hornet's nests in an archaeological site. So
they might be along roads and such, perhaps.
If they find something that would create a...
Sure. In that case,
usually what it is that the local tribes contacted if they found something of any significance. But we're talking about known archaeological sites, and so we know where they're at. What we can't do is publish a map where they're at. So,
I agree.
Present code, there's a 1,300 foot setback for archaeological sites?
No.
Siobhan said that came out of another code.
Oh.
Yeah. So our code is a notification process, and then we have a James and enough about
yeah, it. Yeah, real quick. It's called a historic review committee. If there's some kind of improvement or development on one of these historic sites, we have to notice this historical review committee. They look at what they want to do, see if there's any significance, and respond back to us.
We know those folks are pretty thorough. As we saw the other day.
They keep track of things, huh?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a proper way to go. Siobhan?
No, it's fine. Whatever you decide.
We'll put that together as an option.
Okay.
Just like you're doing options. And then just bring it back to committee next time. Okay. I wanted to go through the rest of what I have highlighted in here and just see if we can knock a few things off. So graph-wise, we've got some cleanup.
Sorry.
Done on page 8 under wildfire safety. We had in there that wildfire safety plan and driveway access plan required for all facilities per the requirements of Article 76 was applied to new structures within a forest zone.
Mm-hmm.
Note my note.
Yeah, and I thought the fire marshal was involved in that already.
Yeah, and pretty much he said, what, leave it up to the ODF standards, as I recall, or as far as...
Well, did you ask him to write that or something, to write some stuff?
Yeah, it's in my binder, which I don't have on me at the moment.
Okay.
And this only addresses new structures, not existing or colos.
Uh-huh. Well,
do you have any thoughts on that, James? We're currently asking a question. I don't have an answer.
Yeah.
What specifically is the question?
I think Charlie did do a little bit of comments on that when he was here. He's not here today, but maybe we need to get him to...
Just ask him to respond to it again.
Yeah, okay.
Just confirm it.
Yeah.
We'll get a confirmation from Charlie.
So the biggest question would be, what is what a wildlife safety plan and should it be implemented? Is that the question? What is it?
No, the question is that Article 76 contains a bunch of standards that aren't applicable to this kind of facility.
There's
it's the fire safety zone around the house.
Right. And well, so, be as applicable.
So rather than applying the requirements of Article 76, do we just want to say a wildfire safety plan, a driveway access plan, approved by the local fire district or fire marshal shall be averted.
I would imagine so, because they might want, you know, a green buffer. As you know, if we've seen this plan, they want us to.
Your house doesn't. They're going to still require the buffer.
Right, but it may not be the same as a resident.
Well, we might have that. We might have the circumstance too, where we've got conflicting standards again. We've got, you know, we're trying to hide a tower in trees for potential access, and the same time the fire marshal, that one's 100 foot.
Yeah.
Well, and realize these cell buildings, unless they're forced to do something different, would be non-burnable. They're a cement rock aggregate thing, totally non-burnable. And if it's not in a building, the new kind that they're setting would be an outdoor cabin, looks like a refrigerator. And they're metal, and they're non-burnable. My point being that the setback should be as much as they are closer into a forest, because we don't want a bigger buffer, then they shouldn't have to have a bigger buffer.
What's in the backup generator?
What's in the backup generator?
Isn't it run by diesel?
No, they're propane. So you're going to have a propane tank sitting out there. So if the fire comes around it might be nice to not have a propane tank blow up. So that's reversed. So the cell site, you know, causing the fire that...
Right.
Forest, a
buffer either way.
Yeah. But I would imagine it could be less than a home, but I don't know.
That's why Article 76 is there. Either the home starts burning and then catches the forest on fire, or vice versa. It doesn't matter. We just want to buffer around them. So.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of a fire safety plan approved by the fire marshal or fire district is better than a reference to Article 76.
Probably so. Might seem more current. Might be put in current standards.
So if you're going to have to change that to fire district to fire authority.
Okay. Right.
Because we don't have a district yet.
Unless
it's in the Applegate.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So, fire authority.
Okay. Change district to authority, and that'll cover whoever the authority is in that location.
We have on page 9 visual impact. We've got what's shaded there in both subsections R and S.
The note refers to the visual impact one, and I do have a question about that.
Right, and you had some additional comments today.
Yeah, that's the today.
Okay.
And I didn't see anything in the hazardous that bothered me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Hang on, I'm catching up here.
Remember we talked about those IE safety program and...
Okay, R sounds real good to me. But now S.
Then while Steve's reading, you did have the 9906OK dispersal as being irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
That's reserved. We had reserved that for a reason, so I don't see any reason not to strike it at the moment. Since it's blank and empty, it's not affecting us, but just with the ability to do something down the road in case we need to add. So I think we should just leave it in and leave it blank until we have a reason to change it. Okay, visual impact. Shivana's question is, should the apply to things that only get ministerial review? So go ahead, Shivana.
Let me try to recreate this in my mind. The note was suggesting that there is a visual impact standard, which is also in a gray box, but one that we've suggested in the site plan approval. If we put it here, this is what the note is saying, then it will also apply to ministerial.
Because all ministerial permits have to meet the general development standards.
Right.
And the issue with that is that visual impact is a subjective criteria.
Yeah.
Have you done it the best you can? Is essentially the standard. Ministerial permits, by definition, are supposed to be something that you check the boxes and you either issue the permit or you don't issue the permit. It's objective. And that's what a ministerial permit is supposed to be. So that's why I'm saying, and I'm not sure I know how to get there. But I'm throwing it out there that a visual impact standard in a ministerial permit is going to be tough for us to write. A visual impact standard in a site plan approval criteria is better.
Yeah, and all the wording is great. So where it goes, if it's adhered to this degree, it should be wonderful, I think.
Mm-hmm. But
so my question is, I mean, I'm mostly on board, but here's my question. We're talking about a co-location here, for example, where that would get ministerial.
Right.
So we're saying that this visual would not apply to a co-location if it's not here, because otherwise it's the general development standards, and that does the general development standards apply to
everything, including co-location.
Right. So you would be restrictive on co-location.
To sort of boil it down, do we require visual impact mitigation on a co-located site?
Right. There were just a few things that I thought were relevant, but given that the general development standards apply, so that it may already be here. So, for example, exterior finish or something like that, but it's already here. So, it's not a big deal.
So we just move it to the other spot?
Well, it's already, move to the other spot. Or in the other spot up for consideration.
Right.
Page 15 is where it's already at.
Now, well, what about...
Hold on. Right, let's make sure we... So we're going to strike R and...
What was it?
We're striking F2, so we're going to leave S in that location.
Oh, that's separate, yeah.
No, we're going to leave S.
Okay, so we're going to leave S. We're just going to strike R because R is defined elsewhere on page 15.
Well, it's included under site approval criteria, and we're taking it out of there because it would apply to ministerial. Unless there is some way to reduce visual impacts on co-locations that I'm
not aware of.
That could be objective.
But again, the general development standards apply to co-locations also for the ministerial review.
So the exterior finish and that sort of thing. And if we, people...
That's the name.
Want to take a crack at... where's our...
Okay.
So we'll leave F, we'll strike R in this location on page 9. So that is addressed on page 15, so we can move forward with that one.
Because you have you might have the building. I mean, let's say the equipment building that's there from the first company is full, and so the second company puts in new antennas and puts in a new equipment building.
Which they will.
That's what I thought. See, that if for co-location there will be a new equipment building, but if the exterior finish requirement is already there, that's the main issue.
Absolutely.
With the new building.
Absolutely,
and that's not going to change. So.
Right.
Okay, page 11. You're going to have to explain what we're referencing on the notes on the top of page 11. I'm not sure which one I'm referencing to.
The form A, I've looked at this one and I have comments on this, and that's referencing everything that has to do with farm resource districts.
Okay.
Right?
What's
that? So the line on the top of 11 has to do with, if you go back to 10, farm resource district.
Line on the top of 11. Page 11.
But I have a lot of questions about this section.
The rule announced to Brent Murphy, Jackson County, stated that category uses listed in ORS 215 are uses of right to which a county cannot apply supplementary standards. So that is all of that above my note on 11 is relative to 99070A.
So is that just item 4?
That is 4321. That is 1, 2.
Couple of things.
Okay, 3 and 4.
That's what I needed to understand.
I actually have questions here. I don't really want to go into them now. It's in this sheet, number...
And that comes out of the ORS.
Numbers 11, 12, and 13, and it's a really technical thing, and I don't know if we want to go into it here. I mean, my first thing is just a question. Does farm resource districts, which is the title of Section A here in our ordinance, mean the exact same thing as exclusive farm use zones, which is what the statutes talk about? This is going to get really technical.
This is not really.
Oh, not to you guys. I'm going to say, then you're the planner.
This is a broader section.
So you're saying farm resource district is broader than EFU zoning?
Oh, sure. We'll get there. I'll both show you the code.
And this is all coming out of state statutes, so couldn't we even change anything? We're not going to change state
statutes.
So we can look at the code, but I don't see us having a lot of adjustment capability on this section.
Other than?
It's a map. We'll show you in a moment. It's easier explaining the code in front of me.
Okay.
We can look at my question number 12, mm-hmm. which is really technical, but when I did my research, it was a little unclear if the other state statute that's involved here is 215.213. I mean, I just want to look at that.
282.236
priority. I can see a bad law drama on TV happening here.
Exclusive farm and farm resource zones are basically considered the same.
Right.
Farm zones.
So they are considered
farm resource.
EFU and farm resource are two different zones, but we combine them, we treat them as one.
Mm-hmm.
So by calling farm resource districts, or we can call them farm zones, we're talking about two different zones on the zoning map of the county.
But when the statute talks about, the statutes, from what my reading of them, specifically talks about exclusive farm use zones, the zone EFUs.
Right.
Right.
That would be one of our two zones.
And you're talking about
above these
farm resource districts.
Right.
So you're talking about
feeding two birds with one seed.
This is going to be a broader.
That's actually a broader. We're treating it more broadly than the statute does.
Okay.
Because we're lumping in exclusive farm and our farm resource zone rather than just doing EFU. That's a 2-for-1. Because functionally, those zones don't have any difference. I mean, they're separate zoning districts, but.
Well, then, basically saying that the statute limits what we can do in farm resource districts regulate is not actually action. It only limits what we can do at EFUs.
Right. If you want to take out farm resource zones and just have it the exclusive farm, that's going to be a little funky because the rest of our zoning code lumps them together.
So it's matching the code and the state ordinance at the moment.
Yes.
Correct.
Anyway, it gets really technical because I don't remember, I can't believe that I did this, but last time I read this, both all the statutes, and I read the went back to this court decision that you mentioned, and I read the court decision and I read the statutes, and my interpretation is a little different from what's implied here. So maybe I could sit down with you at some point.
Let you reevaluate that and come back to us next week.
I'm saying
a state statute that says you're going to do this, and I'm seeing our county code matching the state statute. I don't have a lot of wiggle room that says I'm going to change it.
Right.
No, I'm...
The reference to Brent Mar I took from Snyder's previous ordinance.
Okay.
Well, I'll let you address it next time. Take a look at it and compare to his notes and see what you agree with the note. All right?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. Wireless communication under C, special districts. The co-location or antenna mount centers should be allowed for the general development standard, which seems pretty cut and dry. Prohibited in scenic waterways. Anyone that's been down the road on a jet boat lately, there's a big giant monopole disguised as a pine tree sitting way on top of the mountain. Mm-hmm. It is visible for a mile and a half, 2 miles out.
Because it's bigger.
Because it's a monster.
You wouldn't know that it wasn't a tree if it weren't bigger than all the trees.
Yeah. You just think somebody cut the trees around it and left that one.
And that kind of gets back to my point. Even though it's camouflage, it's a 150-foot monster.
But it's not in the trees, it sounds like.
No, it is. Oh, it's right on top of the ridge. You see it going down the river. You'll see one tree that's like 80, 90 feet taller than every other tree on the mountain.
Moving on.
Okay, one and two look fine. Anyone from here? One and two in blue?
My note below it sort of explains why it's in there, where it's in there.
Well, let me ask about two just so I can be curious, or so I don't have to be just curious. The scenic waterway regarding the tower we were just talking about, what is it, further away from the water to be out of the scenic waterway? Or is it, must have been, because they're not, it's prohibited.
It's pretty far from the river itself. I would say at least a half mile.
Well, it must be out of the zone, because it's exclusively prohibited otherwise.
It actually sits just outside.
There you go. Just outside. They found a spot to make everybody happy.
So, I don't see any problem with those.
No.
Page 11 is okay. Mm-hmm. On this question on 11.
Yeah.
Page 12. State Commissioner
James and I are leaving at 5 o'clock, by the way. James and I, he has to go to
pick up children.
Pick up children.
Yes.
We don't worry anymore.
Okay, so. let's stop and leave it off at page 12.
Okay.
We'll evaluate it, Commissioner. That puts us pretty much most of the way through the definition. Next meeting agenda, we've already got, we're going to start with setbacks. We're going to do our vote. We're going to go to property values. We're going to cover that real quick, and we're going to vote on that. We're going to finalize the page 12 to 17, which should be pretty easy with.
If people could, in the meantime, between now and the next meeting, on this draft, focus on between page 12 and page 17, the end, and sort of check whether you think that the highlighted language is fine or not. So you can press the language that has strike through is okay being stricken or not. That's just cleanup for me.
Yeah, we can take care of that.
So just one possibility, keeping the possibility, I think also with the setback limitations, if the committee is really divided, the idea that you have, if going even to the public hearing with that discussion or the different possibilities.
Present it to the planning commission.
Or the planning commission or something like that.
And that's a viable format. Mm-hmm. And then you'll have more input, more public. It'll be a public meeting.
Options and justification. That's exactly what you said to bring here.
Yeah.
And looking at the next couple of months, I'm envisioning, you've got two options. These are your options. You can go to the workshop with the planning commission and present those options, and then kind of get their feedback and nail one down that we're going to take to them as a final draft. Or the options are presented, the planning commission takes a look at them. And then
they can
the recommendation from the subcommittee might be to go to the public hearing with the options on setbacks.
Yeah.
And let the public really weigh in on it.
And the planning
commission. You've got a couple of different ways to go there, and I think if nothing else, even if you don't get a final nailed down answer from the committee as to what the setback is going to be in black and white, at least come up with a way that you're going to present it to the planning commission and then your recommendations on how it gets treated in a public hearing. And I think you're giving them some options, and you're giving them a recommendation, even though that recommendation has alternatives.
If it went to public hearing, who would be the parties present?
Well, it'd be an open house or a planning commission.
Well, who's representing what? I mean, how would that go?
The county. We're the applicant.
So the county is
applicant.
So
yeah, because the Board of County Commissioners told us to do this. Like the public hearing that you heard the other night. Is you have the applicant, you have the staff report given by James, you had ODOT as applicant stand up and give their spiel, and then you had opponents
Sure. Proponents, opponents, neutral parties.
So you guys will be the O guy.
Essentially.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're
going to give a staff report.
She was horrible.
We'll give a staff report. And then a member of your subcommittee, probably Ron, who is the chair of the subcommittee.
Which I can't do because I'm not the chair on the PC now, too. So.
Right. You can give the report from the subcommittee.
Gotcha. Now the public knows what's going on. What's there to comment on?
Right. Yep. Essentially, Ron is taking the role as ODOT at that point.
Right.
And we'll have a quorum amongst the rest of the commissioners. And now Vivian is on the committee, but for this purpose, I would suggest that the chair of your subcommittee be the one that actually presents the subcommittee's work. The subcommittee could decide that Shabana, Steve, Taz, anyone else on the subcommittee could also present that. That's up to you guys, and that's probably a decision you ought to make.
And we'll settle that at the next meeting. So, next meeting date?
That's a good idea. And if you'd rather have Ron sitting on the board as well, or sitting on the commission to make the decision, I'll let you ponder that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I could do both, because I could present it on the dais, as long as I'm not presenting a specific plan over other plans. If I presented all of them
as the subcommittee,
I think that can carry.
Right. You probably also need to, at that time, address the potential bias issue.
Yeah. But I don't see an issue with that. So as long as if I go up there and say, hey, I want to do this plan, and they don't, then I'm biased in it. Mm-hmm. You're going to have an issue. But if I go up and say, these are the plans that we've come up with.
The findings of the subcommittee.
And we're submitting three for the review of the public and the commission to evaluate these and give us a direction as to what's the preferred. And I don't see any reason why we couldn't do it that way. Okay, calendar.
October.
We
have the 5th, 12th, the 19th, and the 26th.
19th?
Works for me.
19th, 3 p.m. Paul, Jim?
This is Paul.
19th, 3 p.m.
of October for the next meeting.
Where are we now? We're in
We're in September.
The 19th is a little tricky for me. Because I'm preparing for a big event over the whole weekend. Can we go in one direction or the other?
12?
I'd rather go 12 than 26. I can't do 26.
Okay.
We're how far from now is the 12th?
Three weeks, 4 weeks? 3 weeks, because today's the 21st. 22nd.
Yeah, 3 weeks.
So you want to do 3 weeks?
Yeah.
I don't see a problem with doing it in 3 weeks.
Okay, I'm better off that time. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, the last week.
So we're going to go to the 12th at 3 p.m.
Okay.
Paul, Jim, thank you. We'll see you on the 12th. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Bye.
To facilitate, could you, for the next meeting,